Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Woman is Views. Woman is Views is delighted to feature Rogathi Wanjuki, a feminist and activist and outspoken rape survivor who works tirelessly to raise awareness and facilitate discussions about sexual violence, as well as focus on gender and social justice issues. She first became public as a survivor in 2009, as a rape survivor, I should say, in 2009, when she was a student at Tufts University, where she was assaulted by a fellow Tufts student that she was currently at the time in a relationship with. And Tufts University ultimately at the time refused to take the needed action when she tried to report this attacker. And from there, that has begun her public activism work. But there's much more to her, and we definitely would love to get into discussion. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, welcome. First thing I'm going to do, because I'm a stickler about this, is to pronounce your name for me so I can get it stated correctly.
Sure, it's Wagatwe Wanjuki.
Oh, I was not far off. I was practicing, believe it or not, because I'm very stickler about making sure that you represent somebody the correct way. Again, thank you
totally
for joining us today here on Woman is Views. Let's go ahead and get into it. I have to say, in following your story, I just have to applaud you for not only coming forward about the assault that you experienced, but the unwillingness to remain silent about what happened to you and for your current activism. I think a lot of times when it comes to survivors of any type of assault or victimization is that the first thing we think about doing is to becoming silent. So I have to ask you, what made you speak out, and where did you find that courage to actually speak up?
I think it was really understanding that one of the biggest reasons why sexual violence is so pervasive is that there's so much stigma and silence around it. And I really felt that sharing my story was really the only thing I could do at the time. I was feeling very disempowered, and I thought that let me share my story, let me be able to sort of change the dialogue, that this is something that we should not be ashamed of experiencing, and that we need to really blow the lid off of this this epidemic that's happening, you know, not just in the U.S. or on college campuses, but around the world. So it really felt like the right thing to do. It didn't feel like a huge decision. It just felt like the natural decision to make for me. It said, you know what, let me just put it all out there. Let me show that, you know, there's no shame in being a survivor. There should be no stigma about being as such. And by coming forward and sharing the reality of this, that we will be able to make steps closer towards achieving true justice.
Well, thank you for that. Again, once again, I do applaud you, and especially for speaking to the fact that we should no longer have this stigma. There's nothing wrong with being for surviving something. Being a survivor should not be a stigma, and I would like to get into that a little bit later, a hashtag that you had around that word survivor. We definitely can get into that. There's a lot of talk now about this Title IX and the need to enforce it, part of the education. So my question to you, do you think that will be enough to deal with the issue is just to look at Title IX and think that will be the the complete solution for what's going on university campuses? Is there some way to make sure that that's going to make them compliant to the amendment, or should we be looking at more than just that?
I think Title IX is a really great policy because it is so powerful in the sense that there's been the flexibility to really interpret what it means. And, you know, Title IX is a statute that says it does not allow sex discrimination on college campuses or on campuses in general that are getting, you know, funding from the government, from the federal government. And essentially they recognize that being a survivor of sexual violence is an act of sexual discrimination, and you're not getting your equal access to education. Because obviously if you're being assaulted or sexually harassed, you're not able to be the best student that you can be, and it's going to negatively influence your experience during your academic career. So while Title IX is not the end-all, be-all, I definitely think it has been a really great beginning. It's been a very empowering tool, and I think it has a lot of potential if it is properly enforced and properly followed. And I think that's why we're still seeing legislation being pushed in the, you know, in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, because while Title IX, you can do a lot, there's also the CLEAR Act, which students have been doing some activism under, but we still need to do more. But I think Title IX has been a really great starting point, just in the sense that saying, look, being a survivor, being assaulted, really does impact your academic career, and schools really need to do their jobs to make sure that the impact of being assaulted is minimized as much as possible by having really comprehensive sexual assault policies.
Agreed, thank you. And I do agree with the portion of that. We have to keep our eye on the ball when it comes to making sure it's actually enforced. I think that a lot of times we have existing legislation, but then there's not that enforcement or any oversight to make sure that happens. And my other, I guess, concern about it is that it will address things from a legislative standpoint, but how do we go ahead and address the rape culture? I know there's this news, something recently that caught the news or media headlines was this current assault. I forgot the campus that it happened on, but it seems that the gentleman who committed the attack pointed to the media and the movie 50 Shades of Grey of saying, I know, some kind of excuse as to, I was just acting out what I saw on the big screen. And the big screen has always been pointed to as a site for rape culture and getting this stuff across. So how do we try to address that and not give people excuses for their actions while we're addressing that?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I think the conversation is so important about what's happening on college campuses, because we really need to be talking about consent long before people go onto a college campus, because we also have to acknowledge that not everyone does go to college, not everyone can, or not everyone wants to. And we really need to look at how our society as a whole normalizes rape culture and normalizes sexual violence, and sometimes even romanticizes it or frames it as something that is normal and desired, something that we should be doing. So this is why I think it's really great. There's been some campaigns to include the concept of consent within sex ed, which I think is, makes a lot of sense. We really need to teach young people, honestly, people of all ages, what do healthy relationships look like? What do healthy sexual relationships look like? What's affirmative consent? How to get affirmative consent? And to make sure that you're always in touch with your partner, and making sure that you're making sure that they're participating freely and enthusiastically in every step of the way.
Thank you. I'm going to back up a little bit because I like to always define some of the terms that we use, because I know sometimes terminology or we talk about different types of legislation make over some people's heads. Could you back up for a moment and talk about affirmative consent? Because I think that's a very important term.
Sure. So when we talk about affirmative consent, it's sort of a flip. Another phrase for it is yes means yes. So it's sort of a flip off of the old phrase saying no means no. Before people start talking about affirmative consent or yes means yes, I used to say a lot in my speeches that the absence of no does not necessarily equal a yes, and we really need to make sure that one's sexual partner it's if you initiate sex, it's on you to make sure that your partner is freely and enthusiastically engaging in the sexual act in every single phase. So affirmative consent kind of takes the burden off of the potential survivor and saying that, you know, it's on you for you to say no. It's on you to, like, gouge out the eyes of your assailant. And instead, we're going to flip the table and say, hey, the person who initiated sex, did you do your due diligence in making sure that the other person wanted to participate in sexual acts with you?
Thank you for that clarification. I always think that we need to define things as we state them so we all know that we have this common language and understanding. Back to the whole statement that we were talking about, the survivors, and there's no stigma in survivors. You had these hashtags that I saw across social media and was eagerly following. There was one that there's no perfect victim, and the other was survivor privilege. Can you share the sentiments that you wanted to get across with each of these hashtags?
Sure. So most recently I started the hashtag along with Julie from the website Mike that writes about a bunch of awesome issues. It was in response to the Emma Sokowitz article. It was about Emma Sokowitz in the Daily Beast, basically criticizing her actions and her conversations with her assailant after she had been raped. And somehow the author said that, you know, by having text messages with her rapist afterwards, it shows that she wasn't truly assaulted, and trying to say, hey, Emma didn't perform in this XYZ way, therefore it must mean that she is not being truthful in her actions. And Julie and I talked about this, and we thought it was really harmful, and it kind of played into this idea that there is one way to respond to sexual violence and that there is a perfect way to do it. And just as there's no one way to be victimized, there's no one way to be a victim and to respond to that. So we really wanted to flip the idea that, hey, we need to stop scrutinizing the actions of people who are brave enough to come forward and say what happened to them. And we really need to acknowledge that there's a lot of nuances and there's a lot of different ways to respond. If we're thinking about the dynamics of campus sexual assault, very often you're assaulted by somebody who's close to you or in your social circle, and it might not be safe for you to, approach the person, confront them. If someone is capable of violently raping you, they clearly are somebody that you might not be the most comfortable, confronting saying, hey, you did this to me. So I think we really need to make sure that we know that these are the psychological aspects, these are the social dynamics that might be created in response. So we created this hashtag really to really work to dispel the myths that we have out there. And I really was happy to really show that, hey, we have this weird double standard where we're still scrutinizing the actions of survivors rather than looking at what assailants or, alleged assailants have done. When it came to survivor privilege, I did that in response to a column by George Will in the Washington Post, who essentially said that, women are lying about being raped because being a survivor has become a coveted status that, gives privileges to the person. And I made the hashtag sort of because I was really angry and upset, and I wanted to make a really productive response to what he had written. And I think it once again is sort of dispelling these myths that there's anything to gain by saying that you've been raped. No one in the history of the world has ever really made money and created a better life for themselves by fabricating a rape that they've gone through. Like, there's a lot of negative consequences that impact somebody long after they're assaulted. And we really need to look at the reality that there are economic, there are academic, there are social, there are so many negative ramifications that people endure, and that's why so many people don't come forward. So the survivor privilege hashtag was really a way to create community as well for people to share their stories, but also to be an educational tool for people to learn about the reality of rape and realize why that false rape reports are just exceedingly low, between, 2 and 8%, which is no higher than, other violent crimes. There's actually a higher rate of people filing false auto theft reports than false rape reports.
So what was the overall response to each of these hashtags? Or did you get any negative backlash or feedback, especially being that we're talking about something like the internet where there's a lot of opportunities for people to insert that type of, those type of comments?
Yeah. So, as a digital strategist, I try to make sure to create hashtags that can't be easily hijacked. So when we're talking about survivor privilege, it was near impossible to really have people jump onto that hashtag and use it for, for attacking survivors. And I feel like there was the same situation with "there is no perfect victim." There was a little bit more negative backlash for "there is no perfect victim," just because I think there will always be people who are doubting survivors and doubting women, thinking that, women are lying and they don't know what actually happened to them. But at least for me personally, I'm happy to say that there wasn't as much of a backlash. And I think because of the language that we use in the hashtags, people would have to go more out of their way to really attack individuals who participate. And I've been in the public eye for a while, or, long enough. It's been about almost 5 years. And I'm no stranger to random people, attacking me or sending me hate mail or saying terrible things about me. But I realize that for every piece of negative mail I get or negative comment I get so many more positive feedback and thank yous from people who feel less alone and feel more empowered. And that's why I will keep on doing it, even if people will inevitably, try to send me some really terrible mail.
Yeah, still applaud you for that, because, again, it's not just coming forward that takes the courage. It's to be able to deal with that, being in the public eye and getting these letters constantly. And like you said, there's always the uptick of it is that you also get support in coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how important has digital activism been for you? Do you believe that it has helped you get your message across to an even much larger audience, that we should use this platform for this purpose even more?
Yeah, so one of the reasons why I've been so drawn to new media is that I believe that new media and social media have been really great tools for the most marginalized people, for the people that we don't normally see in the mainstream media. They're able to have their stories told, and not just their stories told, but told on their own terms, which I think is really important and really valuable, especially when we're talking about sensitive topics like rape or racism. I first turned to the internet because I honestly had always been a fan of it. I used to be blogging before the word blog was a word. So I was always drawn to the internet. And I was trying to get my story into the media. I tried to reach out to traditional media, news shows, et cetera, et cetera. And they kept on turning me down, for whatever reason. I guess, a lot of times the media is looking for a very specific type of narrative or specific type of victim or victimization. So I created my own blog and I created my own website. I actually taught myself how to create a website, how to make a WordPress, how to register my own domain, how to pick my host, how to edit HTML and CSS. I taught myself all those things so I can create my own hub online to create my own safe space to share my story. And that's why the internet has been so great. And I think that's why we've been seeing so much more activism around topics like Ferguson, Trayvon Martin, even just a recent ruling by the FCC about net neutrality has been really important, because we want to be able to have the voices of all people, regardless of their identities or how much resources they have or how much money they have, to be able to have someone hear their story and for them to share it and to organize and for us to share with one another. So that's why I love the internet, and I can do it, just from my phone or from my house. People are able to connect with one another from around the world, and I think that's why we've been seeing a lot more visible movements and a lot more powerful movements in the past couple of years.
Yes, I think that the recent news that came down today on the upholding of net neutrality for now it's something that I think we should all be very excited about. It's just one step, but there'll be other attacks on net neutrality. But in order for the internet and digital activism to continue in the way that it is being used, I think that net neutrality is going to be the key to that. So
definitely,
we should rejoice in that small victory. I just wanted to touch on something you kind of touched on about going to reach out to traditional media in the beginning of when you set out to share your story, and I'm looking for a specific type of victim or narrative. Do you think that anything about that has to do with the fact that you probably were not the specific victim and that you were a young Black woman at the time? Did that have an impact on the face of rape that they wanted to put out there or victim or what? And a lot of times people talk about that Black women are not always often given the opportunity to be seen as victims. Do you think that kind of played into your story as well?
I personally believe so. Time and time again, I would talk to different shows or networks, and then they would end up choosing, you know, the pretty blonde girl who, who's crying on screen. I think they're very looking for a particular type of person. And unfortunately, we live in a society where not only does media shape what we believe in, like, our culture, but also our culture shapes our media. So, you know, producers are very aware that more people are going to identify more with people of a certain look. And there's a lot of negative stereotypes about Black women, especially when we're talking about sexual violence, right? Like, historically, to excuse the abuse of Black women as slaves, especially the sexual abuse, society started framing Black women as unrapeable beings. And that's why we have these myths of the hypersexualization, and that's why we have this idea of, if a woman is so hypersexual, then she can't be raped. And I think that's why there has been less care and concern for survivors of all identities, but especially for Black women. So, when I first started out, I didn't realize that there would be this lack of concern. I definitely noticed that my race played a part in my school not caring about what happened to me. And it makes sense, by going to a predominantly white institution headed by a bunch of old, rich white guys who have no idea about the experience of a Black scholarship student who's a first generation American, you know, trying to make it. So I think my identity continued to sort of influence about, like, who cares about what bodies and what happens to them. It just manifested in different ways in different situations.
Yes, well, thank you for sharing that. I wanted to make sure we did touch on that. I think that goes back to your story about not only who's the perfect victim or who had that victim privilege or survivor privilege, in a way that sometimes as Black women you're not seen as the victim. So we want to also address that and make people aware of that, the difference in the way that we are treated in that respect. And I also wanted to give you another congratulations on being named one of Planned Parenthood Action's 99 Dream Keepers. I'm very excited for you for getting that recognition. What was your first reaction when you were informed of this recognition?
Well, first, thank you. And I was really excited and honored to be. It was a very pleasant surprise just to be named by Planned Parenthood, which is a tool in providing comprehensive reproductive health care to Black women and just generally, like, very marginalized individuals who oftentimes don't have access to traditional, health care through, a private doctor. So it was great to be seen as a doer, and I think it's a great step in sort of framing the campus rape debate as, like, it's not just about privileged white girls, but about people of all identities, especially Black women. And I think we have so much further to go when we're talking about campus rape of people of all races, because I just honestly think we're not doing enough. So I was really pleased and honored to have an organization to see my work and realize that, this is about also the Black community and, like, what can we do to help each other and help ourselves?
Yes, yes. And thank you for pointing out all the other things that Planned parenthood does, because I know we always have to deal with the different misconceptions, and there's so much more to that. I always say that their role to me is protecting women's human rights and health. So
yeah,
there it is with that. There's a lot of times that people have a little bit of a backlash whenever you bring up the discussion of Planned Parenthood, but it's great to have people clear about their role and what they actually do.
Yeah,
my other question to you is, these are things that I've always seen come across my desk and people thinking these are great ideas. I'm like, let me propose that question to you. What are your views on these rape prevention products? I've seen so many now, and there's one that's the anti-rape nail polish that can detect date rape drugs that may be slipped into your drinks. Is it to you really fair to place this complete burden of rape prevention on women? Because that's what they seem like to me. Like, it's your job. It's kind of like
right. You
bring the birth control and you make sure you don't get raped as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
Right. No, I totally agree. It's like, they're not rape prevention. Like, first of all, I think we need to talk about, like, it's risk reduction at top of it. But the only way really to prevent rape is to get rid of rapists, right? So you might wear your anti-rape nail polish or your anti-rape underwear, but what about the person next to you, right? And at the end of the day, even if your nail polish or your underwear saves you, the person next to you is not going to be saved by that rapist, because that rapist still exists. So what we really need to do is work on not enabling rapists, making sure we don't have a society that creates rapists. I think all these products, while they might have good intentions, I don't think the good intentions really matter as much, right? Because it still enforces this idea that it's on the burden of victims or potential victims to stop rape from happening. And that's just not how life works. That's not how crime works. You don't stop the crime by, ignoring the person who commits the crime, but then have everyone like, oh, if you have an extra $100 to spare or whatever, you know, you have to wear this sort of thing. And also, I definitely think that these products kind of ignore that people of all sexual, of all genders are assaulted. So yeah, there's anti-rape nail polish, but first of all, maybe I don't like wearing nail polish. Maybe there's a male who doesn't like wearing nail polish. You know what I mean? It's just so short-sighted. It's like, do we really think we're going to solve rape by giving everyone a bottle of nail polish? I really don't think so. And also, when we're specifically talking about the nail polish, the thing is, the most commonly used rape drug is alcohol. It's actually not roofies. Rapists use alcohol to pry and, like, lure their victims. So if someone's already consciously drinking alcohol, we're really not doing anything by giving them some special nail polish. And most rapists are people that the victim knows. So we're still not really truly understanding what most sexual assaults entail. And that's why we really need to focus on true prevention, which is talking about consent, making sure that we're not raising rapists, making sure we're not enabling rapists. And I think that's how we're going to truly create a...
Thank you for that, and for that, pointing out that it's nothing more than risk reduction. I think I will go forward and explain that to others in the way that you just have. I think that's a very critical way of looking at it, that it's not stopping rape. It's at the end of the day, as you pointed out. So thank you again for that. And thank you for joining us. Let me say this again. Wagati Wanjuki. Did I get that correct? I wanted to thank you again for joining us here on Womanist Views. And would you like to share information on where people can get in contact with you? Okay, it looks like we may have lost our guest, but I want to go ahead and once again say thank you to Wagati Wanjuki, a feminist and activist and outspoken rape survivor who tirelessly works for raise awareness and facilitate discussions about sexual violence. Thank you for joining us again for another episode of Womanist Views.